This is Taking AIM, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking AIM starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to another riveting episode of Taking AIM. I'm Steve Woodward, and alongside me is none other than David Hensley. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone. I'm so excited about our special guest today.
Yes, we will be speaking with Michael Miller, who is the Southeast Regional Manager of Turning Point USA, an organization you no doubt became familiar with during the last election cycle when Charlie Kirk and his team played a major role in getting out the youth vote for President Trump and other Republican candidates in numbers which have never been seen before, especially among conservative white college males and also among black and Hispanic males. So we will talk to Michael a little bit later in the show. We're going to begin, as we always do, by identifying this week's public enemy number one. It was kind of a slam dunk. I don't even
unanimous.
Think anybody came close. And, you know, I was almost going to let it go because his first transgression occurred more or less a couple of weeks ago or 10 days ago. But then he piled on again. So let's reveal the identity. He is public enemy number one. He is North Carolina Senator, it pains me to say it, Tom Tillis. A registered
Tom with an H.
Thom, yes.
Thom Tillis.
And he likes to thom his nose at conservatism.
That's what he does.
Whenever
he thoms
gets a
his
chance.
Nose
yes.
at conservatism. He's a trans Republican, is what he is.
So, you know, this is not the first time that we have seen him show his true colors as a trans Republican. A line we stole from our friend up the road,
Ms. Rackmuth.
Yes, but. As you may recall, Donald Trump very smartly nominated a gentleman named Ed Martin to become U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, arguably one of the most important U.S. attorney positions because, of course, of its efforts to or its potential to drain the proverbial swamp. It took no time at all for Senator Tillis to raise red flags about Ed Martin. Play clip one.
He is, I don't believe he's being advanced to the markup, and I met with Mr. Martin, who seems like a good man. Most of my concerns related to January 6th, and he built a compelling case on some of the 12 prosecutions that were probably heat-of-the-moment bad decisions, but where we probably have a difference is I think anybody that breached the perimeter should have been in prison for some period of time, whether it's 30 days or 3 years is debatable, but I have no tolerance for anybody who entered the building on January the 6th, and that's probably where most of the friction was.
I see, so he disagreed with you on that?
Well, no, I have to say that Mr. Martin did a good job of explaining how there were people that probably got caught up in it, but they made the stupid decision to come through a building that had been breached and that the police officers and others were saying, stay away. So the difference wasn't that they should be charged, in my estimation, it's by how much. That's an argument I'm willing to have, but we have to be very, very clear that what happened on January the 6th was wrong. It wasn't, it was not prompted or created by other people to put those people in trouble. They made a stupid decision and they disgraced the United States by absolutely destroying the Capitol, and I can't have any patience.
It sounds like your concerns were not alleviated.
But let me be very clear, though. Mr. Martin did a good job of explaining the one area that I think he's probably right, that there were some people that were over-prosecuted. But there were some, 200 or 300 of them, that should have never gotten a pardon, and he agreed with that. But the disagreement there had more to do. If Mr. Martin were being put forth as a U.S. attorney for any district except the district where January 6th happened, the protest happened, I'd probably support him, but not in this district.
Well, and of course, who was really ultimately the stupid one? That was Tillis, because Donald Trump ultimately withdrew Martin's nomination, and he now has nominated Judge Jeanine Pirro, who is likely to be every bit as effective in that role. And see, here's what the swamp guys are worried about, like Tillis. They're not really worried that Ed Martin, as U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, is not capable of doing the job. He certainly is. What they're worried about is how many curtains he's going to draw back on their corruption.
Right.
And that would be his primary mission in that role. And therefore, they had, you know, they let Tillis be sort of the guy taking the arrows, but there were a lot of other Republicans who would probably have not supported Ed Martin.
So two quick observations before we go on to a second transgression. First, the joke's on Tillis because greatest of all time President Trump, he took Ed Martin and he put him in charge of investigating government corrupt officials, right?
Yes, the attorney.
Right,
yes.
which is really what, Tillis is trying to protect. Secondly, I don't understand why they keep trying to prosecute federal government corruption out of the Federal District of Washington, where 98% of the voters and your jury pool and your prosecutors are all Democrats. What President Trump ought to do is he ought to take the Federal District of Oklahoma, where not a single county has gone Democrat in like recorded history, right? And they ought to take the Federal District of Oklahoma and take that special, that assistant attorney general, let him and her investigate federal government corruption, let them present it to a grand jury made up of Oklahoma citizens. That's where the investigation of federal corruption needs to happen. It needs to happen in Alabama or Oklahoma or, you know, some state like that.
I think that's an excellent strategy.
I think the Federal District of Mississippi probably has some extra time they could devote to that.
No doubt about it. Well, then Tillis wasn't done yet. Now, the other day, and again, keep in mind there's always a motive for these things. It's not just because of the purity of his intentions. The other day, the President of the United States announced a plan to dramatically reduce the cost of prescription drugs, becoming the first president ever to take that on, talking about reductions in prices from 30 to 80%. Now, this, of course, is a perfectly common sense, long overdue measure using the most favored nations method to even the playing field, even the costs of pharmaceuticals across the board so that the United States doesn't have by far and away the most expensive drugs in the world, which we do currently. Who runs to the microphones to oppose it? Tom Tillis. Why? Because like so many senators, the pharmas are one of his biggest donors. They do not want to alienate these guys. They have a very cozy relationship with the pharmas. Here's what Tillis had to say. Play clip two.
Okay, I'd like to follow your lead. If not, then I'm likely to convene it myself so that I can get everybody in the room and we can have a very transparent discussion and comprehensive discussion about how we fix the value chain and how we ultimately address this problem. The most favored nation coming out of the administration, all these other things are short-sighted, unsustainable measures that are not going to produce the result I do believe all of us on this committee want to achieve. It's not the what, but we've got a very wide range of differences on the how. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So there you have it. Now, so far, we do not know where this is going, how much congressional pushback there will be on the reduction of prescription drugs. But again, Tillis has decided to be the tough guy here. But, you know, it's a problem when you do this enough times and people start noticing. One of the observers of Tillis's behavior took note of it. He just happens to be a fairly famous vocalist and performer named John Rich. Play clip three.
Thom, 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 you were wrong when you went and sold North Carolina out. And thom, 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 you're gonna be gone when that 26 election rolls around.
Look, when your base...
Thanks for nothing, Thom. Go get him, Judge Jeanine.
When your base is making songs to ridicule you, you are toast. You are a cooked goose. But let's look at what this dude is doing. First of all, How much does he pay for prescription drugs? What's the congressional pharmaceutical plan, right?
Yeah,
secondly,
no kidding.
The guy's got tons of money. So, of course, he doesn't care about the cost of drugs. He cares about how much money he gets from the pharma, from big pharma lobby. But more importantly, let's look at what, so Tom said, this isn't going to have the effects that we want. Trump's executive order points out that in the United States, in almost every case, we pay 5 to 10 times more for prescription drugs than other developed nations, right? All President Trump's order says is that the United States is not going to pay any more for a given prescription drug than the lowest price it's sold for at a developed country elsewhere in the world. And Tom Tillis is against that.
Yeah.
That 98% of the people in America should support that, but not old paid off Tom.
That's correct. And don't think that this is not having some measurable effects. Just this past week, Victory Insights surveyed 800 likely GOP primary voters, creating a showdown in the primary between Laura Trump, President Trump's daughter-in-law, and Tom Tillis, 65 to 11. 65% would support Laura Trump, just 11% would support Tillis, and another quarter are still shopping around for their desirable candidate.
So if they did that same poll, but it was ham sandwich first Tillis,
yeah,
it would be the same results. I mean, yeah, I like Laura Trump, but you could poll, would you vote for a ham sandwich or Tom Tillis, and the ham sandwich would win.
And then if it was pastrami on rye, forget about it. Complete blowout.
Correct.
You know, and also, who else is noticing Tillis's behavior? Our very own local Democrats. They have now scheduled on May 31st a Moore County Tillis accountability canvas. They are recruiting Democrats to go door to door, knocking on doors, and explaining to citizens all the reasons that Tom Tillis shouldn't be the senator from representing North Carolina, but not because they want to primary him with another Republican, because they're lining up whoever their Democrat's going to be in the 26th general, which many people believe will be Roy Cooper, the former governor of North Carolina.
Okay, other than the advocating for Roy Cooper, you know, if I could go door to door and, like, you know, advocate that Tillis get tossed out, I'm going to see if I'm free that day. I might join him.
Yeah, that, I mean, that'll be a first. Unity with the Dems.
Right. I just won't be passing out the Roy Pooper propaganda.
Only Thom
could drive us to the, yeah, Democrats' arms.
Yeah, and we could bring snacks and treats too, you know, just to make it a little more an even more unified event.
Well, Tom Tillis does have one strong ardent supporter in Moore County, and that would be none other than Moore County GOP chair Tom Beto, who, when we tried to censor Tom Tillis for similar transgressions 2 years ago, Beto and his boys, they pulled some tricks to kind of prevent that vote.
I believe another censure is in the works in Moore County,
yes,
against Tillis, so we will report on that as it develops. Well, in case you missed it last week, and there was a lot going on with the president taking the Middle East by storm and coming home with billions of dollars in commitments from the various emirs and others. But locally, the Board of Education sat down to take a very important vote, which, of course, David was a part of, regarding the academic calendar. And since this is your expertise, I'll let you describe how this has gone down.
Yeah, so everyone knows, everyone's familiar with the academic calendar. We have this weird law in North Carolina that Phil Berger, the president of the Senate, forced through decade ago at the behest of the tourism lobby, where it forces us to, the tourism lobby doesn't want schools to start until late in the fall. And for two reasons. One is, you know, more hotel bookings at their hospitality places. And two, they want the child labor. They want the cheap child labor slaving away at their hotels and their restaurants till the end of the tourist season. If school starts, they lose their cheap child labor. So, of course, they gave money to Phil Berger. And Phil Berger doesn't deny any of this. He openly admits it. That's the sad thing. And they gave money. They made donations to Berger. They bought off Berger. So he introduced this law, which basically makes The result is our first semester, the North Carolina public schools stand alone in the entire nation where we cannot, because of Phil Berger and the tourism lobby, we cannot end our first semester before the Christmas break. And that leads to all kinds of problems. Everybody hates that. Everybody hates that calendar. We did a survey of Moore County schools, and we proposed two calendars, you know, the one that conforms to law and one that, like, the rest of the country has, and our community college has, and our colleges have, and our charter schools have. Oh, amazing. Our response to that survey was like 100 times more responses we normally get. It was overwhelmingly in support of the alternative nonconforming calendar. So the Republicans, so Berger introduced a bill, right, to fix it, right? But really it didn't fix it. It did not fix it. It acted like it fixed it, but in reality, it did two things. It empowered bureaucrats, the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, which is currently, well, it's a radical leftist organization. It allows them to do administrative punishments on any school district, take their funding away from any school district that doesn't conform. So Berger bill empowers the bureaucracy to do what he's too much of a coward to do and force it himself. And then two, it gives people, everyone that's standing to sue school districts who are nonconforming, whether they have standing or not, right? So we voted for that. And, you know, the results were 5-2. We had a conforming calendar that conformed to law. We had a nonconforming law calendar that, like, 95% of our citizens want and is a standard calendar nationwide.
Benefiting teachers and children.
And children.
First and foremost.
Right. It's 100% to prevent learning loss, and so the students can drop their pack over the break and not have to worry about finals and, you know, term papers and all that stuff. And, you know, here we are once again going to have a calendar that demonstrably contributes to learning loss and isn't good for our students' mental health. They just can't relax. And it's due to one man in the lobby. It's politics at its worst. And this is why, look, if Republicans wonder why they don't win, look, I am living proof. If you're a Republican, if you're a conservative who runs and does what you say and sticks to your values, you're going to get reelected. And you can get other people you can get other people elected too.
Absolutely.
But it's people like Tom Tillis and Phil Berger's why Republicans continually lose control of General Assemblies and the Senate. If Berger and Tillis are on the ballot next cycle, we're going to lose the U.S. Senate and we're going to lose the North Carolina Senate because people are fed up with that.
And just for the record, you, David, and fellow school board member Pauline Bruno.
Yes, we voted. We had
in
the
favor of the proper calendar, the one that would help the kids.
Yes,
and five others voted against it, and of course they carried the day.
Right,
and the kids and the teachers will pay the price for their ineptitude. We've learned about another Republican.
For their lack of intestinal fortitude.
Exactly.
And lack of courage to do the right thing.
Yes, wouldn't that be nice, the right thing?
Yes.
Well, speaking of the right, we've been learning about one who stands on the right with us. He happens to be none other than the brother of the newly elected Pope of the Catholic Church. Pope Leo has a brother who lives in Port Charlotte, Florida. His name is Louis Prevost. He's 73 years old, so that means that the Pope is his kid brother.
Yes.
And he actually is quoted in one of these interviews as saying that it seems like only yesterday I was throwing my kid brother down the stairs, and now he's the Pope,
well, maybe,
he told the New York Times.
Well, isn't the new Pope a little left, a little left?
Well, that remains to be seen.
He has been heretofore. We'll see what he does. You know, all of a sudden you're Pope, and, you know, maybe we'll see. But, you know, he's been leftist kind of his whole life. Maybe his brother pushed him down the stairs one too many times.
Well,
he
that
had
could
a head
be. Well, he
history.
Has been. Now, very. Let's face it, most of us, especially those of us who are not Catholic, knew very little, if anything, about Roberto Prevost, the new Pope Leo XIV. But they've now gone back and looked at his social media, and he has been critical primarily of Trump's mass deportation plans for illegal immigrants. So that, to me, is a major red flag. But the media in the United States have been rushing to find out everything they can about his brother, Louis. And, of course, they're finding that he has been very openly conservative, and as recently as a couple of weeks ago had posted video or commented on video of Nancy Pelosi a mere 30 years ago speaking out in favor of tariffs. And now he posts that now they're crying about it. And do they not know that there is a thing called video?
Right.
Just listen to what this drunk has to say in the mid-90s, referring to Nancy. And I won't get into what else he said. It's a little spicy for radio. He consistently has claimed in other posts, according to the New York Post, that the Democrat Party is filled with communists. Yes, he's right about that. And suggested in one missive that before lefties took over and ruined our schools, they would have been tarred, feathered, and rode out of town on a donkey or worse for screwing people's lives up so much. So I love this guy.
You know, this is going to be, you remember Tampon Tim Walz?
Yeah.
You know, the dude who ran for
vice president.
Yeah, yeah.
So-called.
And you remember, you know, man, they don't come much farther left than old Tampon Tim. But if you remember, his family came out against him. Like, not his wife and kids, but like his brother, sisters,
yeah.
Even his parents came out and said, we don't support anything this guy stands for. So we'll have to keep an eye on, what was his name, Lou
Prevost.
We'll have to keep an eye on. And if I might go visit him next time I'm in Florida.
He seems to be very comfortable in his own skin. He's been more than willing to agree to these interviews with all these media organizations who are clearly trying to, you know, paint him as some kind of a wacky, perhaps even, you know, racist conservative. But, you know, he's not going to take it anymore, as we like to say on this show. One thing we also like to say on this show, David, and you've said it every time we get together, you can't hate the media enough.
Right.
Well, now we have a poll that confirms that.
Yes.
Nearly half of voters believe the news media are biased in favor of Democrats, and most Republicans think it's impossible to hate the media too much. The latest Rasmussen Reports poll finds that 47% of all likely U.S. voters say that in terms of their political coverage, most news media organizations are biased in favor of Democrats.
You don't say.
Only 23% believe the media are biased in favor of Republicans. I don't know who these people are.
Those are the hardcore leftists. Those are people that just outright lie.
I think we refer to them as Starbucks job applicants. digging deeper into this poll, 57% of Republicans agree that it's impossible to hate the media enough. I'm surprised the number is not higher. But this is even more revealing. 40% of Democrats agree, and 36% of non-affiliated voters agree.
We should send those poll results to John Nagy and David Warnoff.
Right.
In fact, we should take an ad out in the pilot.
Yes, exposing these numbers.
Yes, we should take an ad out exposing that, like, you know, the majority of people can't hate the media enough.
And then the poll also discovered one other thing that I think we will not be surprised by. Among those who say most news media organizations are biased in favor of Democrats, 59% believe the media bias problem is getting worse.
You don't say. Because they're getting more and more desperate and shrill. I mean, look at what they've, well, anyway, I mean, they've completely, their Trump derangement syndrome has completely destroyed their profession. They've destroyed themselves and their profession. And, you know, anyway, couldn't happen soon enough.
You're absolutely right.
Because, ladies and gentlemen, you cannot hate the media enough.
Let's say it every week, and let's keep saying it, and then eventually everybody will realize that we were right all along.
Maybe that dude will write a song.
John Rich, yeah.
John Rich will write a song.
Well, he's good at
the Arlo Guthrie of our time.
He's very good at spontaneous combustions like that. So let's hope that he does. Now let's turn to arguably a much more serious story, but I think it's one that we really need to pay attention to because you know we all you and I pay a lot of attention to current events, and yet I have to say that this one sort of took me by surprise. Earlier this week, about 50 refugees from South Africa were given passage into the United States, flown in a private aircraft into Washington Dulles International Airport from South Africa. These are largely people who are farmers with their wives and children who have been enduring unimaginable persecution in their home country. apparently, while we were not really paying much attention to it, there's this entire movement of black South Africans who have risen up with their stated goal of eliminating white South African farmers. They call them the Boers. That's their nickname, the Boers. Eliminating these people and their farms from the face of the earth, and then confiscating the land and redistributing it. Now, this was explained very well by Charlie Kirk on his program earlier this week. Play clip five.
Popular political songs in South Africa is "Kill De Boer," "Kill De Boer." Not an exaggeration. The lyrics are literally just "Kill De Boer," "Shoot, shoot, shoot," over and over again. This is radical Marxist blacks in South Africa talking about how they want to murder white African farmers. Play cut 260. That's the song. One of the largest political parties in South Africa, the Economic Freedom Fighters, is led by a man by the name of Julius Malema. Malema calls for, quote, cutting the throat of whiteness. He has openly said that he might, in the future, call for the extermination of all white people in South Africa. Some people aren't waiting. Every year there are gruesome murders on South African rural farms. There are roads like that of crosses of South African white farmers that are murdered by black radicals.
Wow. And of course, here at home, the left media and the left politicians, their heads are exploding because
yes. All of a sudden they're against immigration.
Yeah. And they don't care that these people's lives are literally at stake. All they know is that they want to undeport people like this Abrego Garcia from the El Salvadorian prison. And they think that this is nothing but Trump's own demonstration of white nationalism in wanting to bring these people to our country and protect them from what sounds to be almost certain death and destruction of their property. I can't imagine a more humanitarian effort than that. And yet the left media here are saying that these South African people should be left to die. But oh, by the way, let's keep all of the criminal illegals that are swarmed in our country the last 4 years. Let's leave them alone.
Right.
And if they happen to commit an occasional murder or crime or robbery, that's okay. We'll live with that.
You remember when we used to joke? We used to joke about this. Is that the minute is that if illegal aliens were conservative voters, right? Conservatives and voted Republican, the Democrats would be against immigration. Well, here we are.
Yeah.
Only Trump can make a move to do two things. One is illustrate the hypocrisy of the Democrat position, because all of a sudden they're against immigration. And by the way, they're fleeing true terror. These are not economic migrants, you know, economic refugees, as the Biden administration put it. And then secondly, it just exposed what racist the Democrats and the leftists are. Because you remember the demonic leader of the Episcopal Church out at the National Cathedral?
Yeah.
Remember her?
Who dressed, inauguration.
Yeah, who dressed down Trump, and then it turns out her organization's been getting tens of millions of dollars every year to resettle, like forever. To resettle refugees. Well, they came out and said they don't believe. They came out and said, this is almost an exact quote, it's against our values to relocate white immigrants. So they're quitting the federal government program. So good for them. Good. They shouldn't get another federal dollar. But more importantly, they need to be investigated for violating U.S. Civil Rights Acts. They need to be prosecuted, and they need to take away their nonprofit status, because you cannot discriminate based upon race or national origin. That's unconstitutional in the United States. But here you are, we have the demonic head of the Episcopal Church doing exactly that.
It is so absurd that only a Democrat could not see the complete hypocrisy in it. And of course, you know,
most Democrats have. That's why the Republican Party and the conservative movement is gaining members, because Any rational human being, regardless of political affiliation, sees the racism, sees the hypocrisy, and is starting to see the left for what they are.
And of course, while they're screeching about bringing in these South Africans, you've got all these Democrats in New Jersey this past week, including members of the clergy, so-called.
Staging their own insurrection.
Blocking the entrance to this detention center, which is intended to incarcerate dangerous illegal immigrants as they are captured in the region.
No, they weren't blocking the entrance, Steve. You had that female Democrat legislator linebacker in the red jacket that was like assaulting federal officers. Yes. She looked like a lineman, man. She was out there with her belly bumping into people. And
her form was good.
Insurrection. I want to see federal prosecutions. And now all of a sudden you have Hakeem Jeffries. If the Justice Department prosecutes them, they're going to pay, right? Yeah. So all of a sudden you have the House Minority Leader threatening, literally threatening federal agents to not prosecute his people, fellow legislators, Democrat legislators who are assaulting, who are leading an insurrection.
Right, and you've got the new...
Where's Tom Tillis? Where's he demanding these people breach, these people violently breach? Why is Tom Tillis not calling for their... No, because Tom Tillis is on their side. That's the dirty little secret. Tom Tillis supports them because he's part of the Uniparty, just like Phil Berger's part of the Uniparty.
Yeah, it's it's not a good situation where you have more in common with the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, who was, leading this protest at this detention center. You've got more in common with him than you do with your fellow Republicans.
Right, you're talking Tom Tillis.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, of course. That's exactly what it is, and that's why he needs to go. If Tom Tillis, I'll tell you this, I posted this on Facebook, and I mean it. If Tom Tillis is on the ballot in the general election in November, I'm sitting the election out.
All right.
I'm just not showing up.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Well, let's close today's show, which has been action-packed. I've really enjoyed all these topics. I just wanted to share this with you really quickly because this is very alarming. You may recall several weeks ago there was an incident in suburban Dallas in Frisco, Texas, where a young high school track athlete showed up at a track meet and before the morning was over had managed to stab and murder a track athlete from another high school. The murderer, the one charged with the murder wielding the knife, is a black athlete. The victim, the dead track athlete, is a white kid. They're both from the Frisco, Texas area. So now, here's what we're learning. Accused murderer Carmelo Anthony, on top of raking in more than $500,000 through GoFundMe, is now being allowed to attend his high school. Will be allowed to graduate from high school with full credit this coming spring in a couple of weeks.
I can assure you of one thing. If that had happened in Moore County schools, that young man would not be graduating.
Luckily, the principal came forward and said he's not going to walk with the graduates. He will just receive his diploma at another time and place. So,
by the way, for the record, the reason why that young man wouldn't have been able to graduate is because we would have expelled him. I mean, you murdered, the kid died, right?
Yeah.
You murder someone, you're done. You're not attending another day of school. You are expelled as of that day, and I'm sorry that you didn't graduate while you're in federal prison. You'll just be a high school dropout spending life in prison.
Our special guest this morning is Michael Miller. He is with Turning Point USA. He is the Southeast Regional Manager of this burgeoning organization, which is capturing... the youth vote, the conservative youth vote on campuses across the country. It is growing exponentially each and every year. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing post-Trump election, and especially with this explosion of conservatism on a lot of these college campuses, especially within the young male population. How do you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you know, we kind of thought maybe, you know, with the election, obviously there was a ton of excitement around that. But, you know, a lot of times after elections die down, the people kind of die down, too. But we have not seen that at all. You know, we've done our college tour events where we do those kind of big rallies at colleges, really all across the country. And we did those during the election season. They obviously had huge crowds out there, you know, with that political excitement around that. But even after the election this past semester, we've done those same events and they've been, you know, the same size, if not bigger. So I think people have really, you know, kind of woken up over that past election cycle. And I think it was an indictment on, you know, it's okay to be conservative, especially at these college campuses where for so long, conservative students just felt like they didn't have a voice. They couldn't speak up. They were going to get canceled or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But I think the election being as overwhelming as it was has really showed people like, hey, you know, we don't have to sit in the shadows or be quiet now. Like, we can speak out, we can make changes. And I think from the college side of things, they've realized, well, we don't really have to cater to the kind of woke mob anymore because that is kind of the minority now. So I think we've also seen them kind of relax some policies and, you know, kind of pull back some of the crazy stuff they had been doing previously as well.
And in an interview recently with the Turning Point USA's founder, the great Charlie Kirk, one of the young men said, you know, the best thing about Charlie's visits to these campuses, other than the event itself, is the hangover, the positive hangover that it provides, because the students are now emboldened to carry out the, you know, what he's calling on them to do, to actively recruit and grow the conservative movement, and they feel empowered to do that, no longer intimidated by the, you know, the inevitable leftist blowback.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we have our college chapters at all of the universities, and every time we have one of these events, those chapters just grow, I mean, quadruple in size there. So then they get to do that impact, you know, for years after that, you know, doing kind of tabling events, recruitment, other speaking events on campus, you know, pushing back against these universities' policies, all that kind of stuff just gets that much more enhanced when we have these big events like that. And we really can show that support that are on these campuses.
Well, when, you know, his visits also do two very important things, you know, in addition to evangelizing the conservative message and you know, mobilizing conservatives, it also demonstrates that the woke mob truly is a minority. And then it also highlights how wacky they are. I mean, the videos are like legendary. I mean, it just highlights how nuts those people are and how few there are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you'd be surprised at the people and the characters you see on these college campuses. It's insane. And I think he does a great job highlighting that. And then obviously, you know, he's just so good at debating, so good at, you know, coming back when they bring up these crazy things. And I mean, all of them just walk away looking even dumber than they looked before.
As they're being handed a hat, a Trump 47 hat, and they're all mad.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, when I started this job, I started as a college student with a college chapter. And we would kind of, you know, do our tabling on campus and stuff, and just the crazy people that would come up. I had some dude wearing a dress come up one time and, like, steal all of our signs and run away in his high heels. And he obviously didn't have a lot of practice in high heels, but, you know.
Well, he should have rehearsed, right?
Before.
If you're going to show up in heels, you know, you got to deliver the goods, right?
For sure.
And furthermore, Turning Point is starting to produce electable candidates. Anna Paulina Luna, a congresswoman from Florida, is a Turning Point alum, is she not?
Yeah, she is. She started as a contributor. She spoke at a bunch of our campus events, spoke at our Young Women's Leadership Summit, and then, yeah, went on to Congress, which is awesome. And I know, you know, we kind of have, you know, we've always done this, but I think we've really kind of leaned into it more, where we're really trying to cultivate, even just with our students, really cultivate that leadership, you know, get them into leadership roles after college, whether that be, you know, in, you know, in an elected position or just in business or just something like that, but really empowering our student leaders to kind of continue that leadership after they graduate college.
And I was reviewing on the Turning Point website the additional tentacles that the organization has grown. There's Turning Point Academy, Turning Point High School, which it makes sense to move into the high school realm.
Can we launch a Turning Point High School here, like a Turning Point Charter School?
Well, so our Turning Point Academy actually does have, I believe, three brick-and-mortar charter schools.
Really?
I believe around the Chicago area. And then kind of their other goal with that is helping parents start their own kind of micro school type thing. So
I was just kidding about the charter school. So
is
the Turning Point High School, is that starting Turning Point chapters at high schools, or is that charter school?
So the academy is the charter school thing, and that kind of deals with the homeschooling charter school thing. Turning Point High School, we launched, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago. So we had been doing, obviously, we started with college chapters. And then we just saw that, you know, once students got to college, a lot of times it was sort of too late. They already had indoctrination in their high schools. You know, these high school teachers are just as crazy as college professors. So we started doing high school chapters, and we really saw the potential there. So we launched the high school program as a separate program, just like the college field program, as its own field program. And it's growing even more than the college program. We're up to 1,200 high school chapters across the country.
So let me say this real quick. I'm on the Moore County School Board. And, you know, we have to be viewpoint neutral, right? So, of course, the Sand Hills Pride, you know, has clubs in our high schools. I would invite Turning Point High School to explore forming clubs in our high schools, because, you know, if the Sand Hills Pride can have their club, then you guys can certainly have your club. Welcome to Moore County Schools if you so choose.
Absolutely. I mean, I believe we have, I want to say, 40 plus high school chapters across North Carolina. And like I said, nationwide, we're up to 1,200 high school chapters. And I think
let's make it 1,201.
Absolutely.
1,203, because we got three high schools. Plus our innovative high schools, 204.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or 2,000 of whatever.
And I think that's really the potential, because, I mean, there are only so many colleges, but every town has a high school.
We have a community college, too, and Mr. Woodward's on the board of
Trustees.
Trustees. So let's get Turning Point active in Moore County.
Yes, absolutely. I am the woke assassin on the board of Trustees.
I was his predecessor as the woke, common sense, return fiscal responsibility to the Moore County schools.
Now, let me ask you about the future of the MAGA movement, because obviously there will come a day when the Trump administration will complete its work. It'll go by very fast. We're already seeing the on the left, they are in panic mode about the shallowness of their bench, so to speak, in terms of future potential, you know, presidential candidates and even for that matter, you know, worthy future members of Congress. They're in such depths now that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is like the rising star, and who can barely form a sentence. But I assume that there is optimism within Turning Point USA that because of the youth movement that is part of MAGA, as evidenced by the Trump cabinet alone, just the fact we have a 40-year-old vice president who, you know, knows Charlie as Charlie and Charlie knows him as JD. I mean, it's, you know, it's a whole different realm these days. How do you foresee this MAGA movement growing through the youth ranks?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the coolest thing is, you know, it's not going anywhere. And I think this last election was an indictment on that, you know, I don't think it's just about Trump, but I think it's really just this younger generation is more conservative. And I think that's going to continue, you know, kind of as we go down these newer generations. I think the big part of that was, you know, we had the COVID and stuff, and these students really saw that, like, hey, you know, the government does some really shady stuff, and we're just not about that. And then with all the social things and social media, all that kind of stuff, too. So, yeah, I mean, I don't see that tide turning anytime soon. You know, I think it's going to, you know, continue to be definitely a different party, I think, than it was before. I don't think you're going to get back to your, you know, old school kind of John McCain type Republicans.
Right,
I mean, that's never going to be a Republican candidate ever again. I think it's going to continue to be a vibrant, kind of more youthful party. And yeah, I mean, I think JD might be, you know, kind of be the one that takes over that kind of nameplate after Trump.
I can tell you this, having two college daughters, you know, one just graduated and the other one's graduating next year. But I can tell you the up and coming generation, because the BS that they've seen, right? You know, they just as they are tired of wokeism, they're tired of the cronyism too. What they want is they want a government that's fiscally responsible, responsive, and ensures maximum liberty for everyone. They don't want the wokeism, and they don't want the cronyism. So you're 100% correct. And the Republican Party right now, whether it be in Moore County or at the national level, we're awash in quality young candidates. But here in Moore County, the cronies did their best. I mean, we had like a great field team of young conservatives, and the crony establishment that ran the Moore County GOP, they did their best to suppress them and keep their cronyism going, just like they did in D.C. But the tide is shifting, and the shift is in our favor because the young people are tired of it, and they're just not going to tolerate either one of wokeism or the cronyism.
And this is interesting. This just came out in the last day or so, a poll that reflects that Democrats remain deeply pessimistic about the future of their party. A new poll conducted by the Associated Press, no less, and an organization called the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, boy, that's a mouthful, found that only about one-third of Democrats are very optimistic or even somewhat optimistic about their party's future, down sharply from just last July when 6 in 10 said they had a positive outlook. I mean, that's like an implosion.
Yeah, it's always shocking to me that they just can't get the candidate thing right. I mean, they're bringing Bernie Sanders back down out of the attic. Like, what? It's just crazy to me. And, you know, you saw the first time Trump was elected, they had 4 years to find somebody to kind of take over the party. That didn't work out for him. And then even this go around, I mean, they just, yeah, it's kind of shocking to me. The party that claims to be the party of young people and, you know, all this, you know, charismatic young people and stuff, they just can't find a decent candidate, which, I mean, I'm not complaining about. It's fine by me, of course. But, you know, keep running the Bernie Sanders and the Joe Bidens and the Kamalas. That's fine by me. But yeah, it's just shocking to me that they haven't figured out, you know, how to recruit a likable candidate in, you know, 10-plus years.
Well, right now, there was a survey done just this last week about the leading contenders for potential presidential runs in 28. AOC was at, like, 21%. Kamala Harris is at 6%. So she's kind of, like, done.
Yeah, yeah.
And then everybody else is in single digits, too. It's just unbelievable. You know, you've got your Cory Bookers and your Jasmine Crockett's and all these.
AOC.
AOC, of course, is considered the model future candidate. But
I mean, she's like supposedly their number one candidate to run for president.
Yes.
Like, I mean, AOC. The problem is the reason why they don't live in reality is the far left wing, the leftists have control of the party. And that happened because when Pelosi first became chair, she got rid of all the moderate Democrats. The modern Democrat Party is who's responsible for that is Pelosi. Because when Pelosi first became Speaker of the House, she took all her campaign money and she primaried out all the blue dog Democrats.
Yeah.
So Pelosi's the one who radicalized the Democrat Party, and then it got out of control. She lost control of it. And then she had to start kowtowing to the radical left that she was responsible for. That's how they got in this pickle.
Yeah, and I don't see them getting out of it anytime soon, to be honest.
Yeah, and you know, look, if they were honest with themselves, they would be suicidal over their prospects.
Yeah, no kidding. So, Michael, Turning Point USA, in addition to its ongoing campus and high school activities, also coordinate some pretty large-scale, events throughout the year, sort of similar to what many of us are familiar with as CPAC. Well, you've kind of created the youth versions of CPAC. I believe in July you've got the Student Action Summit in Tampa, and then you've also got your AmeriFest, which is now an annual event, which is like 50,000 people or some huge number.
It might as well be, yeah, it's huge, huge. I mean, I think that's one of the things we're most proud of is just our events and just how big they've gotten over the years. I've been with Turning Point for 7 years, so when I first started with Turning Point, we had our first Student Action Summit ever, and I think we had maybe 1,000 students, if that, down in West Palm Beach. You know, we had just a very simple setup, you know, no big production, and we thought that was like the pinnacle, like we can't get bigger than this. And then you fast forward 7 years, we just had our America Fest in Phoenix, Arizona in December. We had 20,000 people there. We had President Trump was there. Just a massive production. I think they said they bring in, I want to say 12 tractor trailers worth of, you know, speakers and video boards and laser lights. I mean, it's almost like you're at a rock concert with just the production quality. Yeah. That's been one of the biggest things. And it really works for our students as well. So when they attend one of these events, I mean, they just get so fired up when they go back to their campus. I mean, it's impossible not to, just with the excitement there. I mean, you have conservative students from all 50 states. I think America Fest, we had like, you know, 10 plus countries represented there. So yeah, it's just huge. And I think that's really, you know, one of the things we're most proud of is just how big our events have grown at Turning Point, and just how the quality we've been able to achieve with them.
And to your point, the you don't have any problem attracting speakers. You know, it seems to me that if you watch Charlie Kirk's program, his streaming program, he gets nothing but A-listers. You know, it's like they're clamoring to be on the show. And that applies also to your events. So you've got, in addition to the President of the United States, which is a pretty big deal, you've got, you know, Don Jr., you've got J.D. Vance, you've got the various other firebrands from Congress, you know, Chip Roy and all of those people, Ted Cruz, and the list goes on and on. And even other media celebrities like Glenn Beck and those kind of people want to be part of it.
Well, let Charlie know that Steve and I are available for a show.
Absolutely. You
know, with proper advanced scheduling, of course.
No, yeah. I really, you know, I've said this before, that I think that Charlie Kirk will be the Rush Limbaugh of his time. This is a guy who launched an organization as a teenager, smartly decided not to waste his parents' money going to college. I think more and more people are awakening to that strategy. And now has brick by brick built this organization, you know, into a cultural powerhouse that I think you could arguably say played a major role in the return of Donald Trump to the White House last November.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, obviously with Turning Point USA, you know, we do work with those college, high school students. We have, like I said before, 1,200 high school chapters, I think another almost 800 college chapters around the country. You know, full-time field staff all over the country. And that's just with Turning Point USA. I know you had mentioned the election, our kind of sister organization, Turning Point Action, doing the direct campaigning. I mean, they did, you know, they had, I think, 10,000 plus volunteers doing, you know, vote chasing, door knocking, voter registration drives all over the country and in those, you know, really important swing states, which, yeah, I mean, no doubt, actually, you know, you definitely played a big role. I know I personally volunteered a week in Phoenix, Arizona, doing some door knocking and stuff kind of before the election. And I think they had, I want to say, 1,000 people just in Arizona kind of that, you know, month or two before the election, just there. So, yeah, I mean, Turning Point Action, just as big as Turning Point USA is, Turning Point Action is, you know, just at that same point as well.
And really, I think your organization sort of created this phenomenon, which I had not heard before, called ballot chasing. And basically what that is you go to people who are perfectly capable of voting and are on our side, who simply can be prone to apathy or just being distracted by the realities of their everyday life, their job, their families, and you just get in their face until they vote. It's nothing more complicated than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're just going, you know, knocking on these doors and saying, hey, you know, you received a mail-in ballot, you know, are you going to turn it in? You know, what can we do to, you know, help that process? And I think a lot of it too, and just kind of what I had noticed firsthand when I was volunteering that week, in Arizona, the mail-in ballot was like 4 pages long. They do this weird kind of judges thing where you like have to rank all these choices for judges and stuff. And it's a very confusing ballot. So, you know, we were able to give them, you know, literature and kind of a step-by-step guide, you know, how to fill it out, the proper process, you know, make sure the signatures are correct, all that kind of stuff that, you know, these apathetic voters just may not realize how to do, or they're just like, well, it's 4 pages long, I'm too busy, so I'm just not going to vote. So I think that was a really successful thing, as opposed to just knocking on random doors and saying, hey, you should vote for my candidate. We were actually able to go and find people who, you know, had the ballots, they voted in the past, but they maybe, you know, just don't vote as regularly as they should, and just say, hey, you know, what can we do to get you to vote? You know, is that, you know, helping, you know, find where to turn your ballot in, you know, where your polling place is, whatever we can do to help them vote. And that was super successful, and I think that really, you know, turn the tide in Arizona, Wisconsin, you know, those really kind of swing states where that was, you know, really pushed hard.
Michael Miller, we thank you very much for joining us today from Turning Point USA and enlightening our listeners on all the activities of your organization. And we hope to talk to you again soon. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you all so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Any last messages before you go?
Yeah, I mean, like you had mentioned before, our Student Action Summit, that's going to be July 11th through the 13th. If you are a high school or college student, or you know one, you know, definitely go to our website. I think it's tpusa.com/get involved. fill out that form, get in touch with a local field rep, and get involved in the movement, because like we said, you're in the majority now, so definitely get involved.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a great conversation with Michael Miller from Turning Point USA. We're so glad that he joined us, and we've come to the end of another riveting episode of our favorite Saturday morning show.
I am so looking forward to Turning Point USA high school chapters getting established in Moore County.
Right
school.
Here. I'm Steve Woodward. He's David Hensley. And what are we doing each and every Saturday? We are
taking aim.